From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The payments made by the company at all times were motivated by the company's good faith, desire, and concern for the safety of all of its employees.
Chiquita agrees to pay a $25 million fine to the U.S. government for funding Colombian right-wing paramilitary group designated a terrorist organization by the United States. The group is responsible for the deaths of thousands of people. We'll talk about Chiquita's history and why years ago the Cincinnati Inquirer was forced to apologize for exposing Chiquita's dealings in Latin America. But first, we're joined by the former UN Iraq mission chief, Hans von Sponeck.
The surge of Baghdad, in my view, should become the surge in Washington to try to bring about changes in the U.S. foreign policy on the Middle East.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Capitol Hill, leaders of the Out of Iraq caucus have reversed course and pledged not to block a $124 billion spending bill to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Up until yesterday, California Democrats Maxine Waters, Lynn Woolsey, Diane Watson, and Barbara Lee had criticized the supplemental spending bill for not going far enough to stop the war. Congressmember Lee said, quote, "I have struggled with this decision, but I finally decided that while I cannot betray my conscience and I cannot stand in the way of passing a measure that puts a concrete end date on this unnecessary war. The legislation sets a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops by August 31, 2008, and establishes readiness standards for the deployment of combat troops." Congressmember Waters said she would stop encouraging anti-war Democrats to oppose House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's plan. On Thursday, the leaders of the Out of Iraq caucus held a backroom meeting with Democratic Party leaders. Speaker Pelosi made a final plea to the group, asking it to deliver at least four votes when the roll is called. The members promised 10 votes. Political analysts predict Pelosi now has enough support to have the bill passed. President Bush, however, has threatened to veto the bill. On Wednesday, he said Congress should pass a war funding bill without restrictions. A newly declassified U.S. government report has revealed half the U.S. deaths in Iraq have been caused by explosives seized from old Iraqi military depots that have been left largely unguarded since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Over 3,200 soldiers have died since the war began 4 years ago. Meanwhile, Newsweek is reporting the number of U.S. troops in Iraq will reach a record 173,000 by July. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made a surprise visit to Baghdad Thursday during a joint news conference. Iraq's prime minister said Ban Ki-moon's visit showed the city was, quote, on the road to stability. Minutes later, the news conference was interrupted. A rocket exploded just 50 yards away from their meeting. Ban Ki-moon cringed and ducked at the sound of the blast. Earlier today, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Salam Zoubi was hospitalized after being injured in a suicide bombing near his home in central Baghdad. Police said at least six people were killed and 10 others wounded in the attack. The Guardian newspaper is reporting the Bush administration is scrambling to prevent Turkey from attacking Kurdish-controlled areas in northern Iraq. U.S. officials fear such an attack would open up a third front in the battle to save Iraq from disintegration. Turkish sources said special forces operations have already begun in northern Iraq to target fighters connected to the PKK or the Kurdish Workers' Party. This would not be the first time Turkey has invaded northern Iraq. 10 years ago, Turkey sent 40,000 troops into Iraq. But there has been no large-scale Turkish intervention since the U.S. invasion 4 years ago. The U.S. has vowed to crack down on the PKK, but Turkey accuses the U.S. of playing a double game in northern Iraq. Officials say the CIA is covertly funding and arming the PKK's sister organization, the Iran-based Kurdistan Free Life Party, to destabilize the Iranian government. In political news, Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards and his wife Elizabeth have revealed she's been diagnosed with cancer again. But John Edwards says the campaign will go on.
We've been confronted with these kind of traumas and struggles already in our life. And we know from our previous experience that when this happens, you have a choice. You can go cower in the corner and hide, or you can be tough and go out there and stand up for what you believe in. And both of us are committed to the cause. We're committed to changing this country that we love so much. And we have no intention of cowering in the corner.
Elizabeth Edwards was first diagnosed with breast cancer in the final weeks of the 2004 campaign. She underwent several months of radiation and chemotherapy. This week, doctors found the cancer had returned and that it had spread to her bones. Doctors say her cancer is inoperable. The Senate Judiciary Committee has voted to authorize subpoenas for Karl Rove and other White House officials to testify about the Bush administration's dismissals of eight U.S. attorneys. President Bush has vowed to fight the subpoenas if they're issued. The White House has said Rove and others can meet with lawmakers only if it's done behind closed doors and not under oath. On Thursday, Senate Republican Arlen Specter offered President Bush a compromise. He suggested select lawmakers question Karl Rove and other administration officials in public, but not under oath. On Thursday, Specter and Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy debated what the committee should do. This is Arlen Specter.
If we don't like what we get, we can always issue a subpoena and move with a subpoena if we don't like what we
That's
get.
Not,
why not take what we can get in the interest of...
What we're told we can get is nothing. 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 We're told that we can have a closed-door meeting with no transcript, not under oath, limited number of people, and the White House will determine what the agenda is. That, to me, is nothing.
Senator Patrick Leahy responding to Senator Arlen Specter. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration has rejected calls from Defense Secretary Robert Gates to close the military prison at Guantanamo Bay. During his first weeks in office, Gates argued in private to move the detainees held at Guantanamo to inside the United States. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice reportedly also joined Gates in calling for Guantanamo to be closed. Their arguments were rejected by President Bush, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and the Office of Vice President Dick Cheney. Meanwhile, Amnesty International's urging the United States to abandon plans to try Guantanamo prisoners before military tribunals. Amnesty asked other nations not to contribute any evidence for use at the trials because the group says trials do not meet international standards of fairness. The Army has admitted it's been undercounting the number of soldiers going AWOL. Up until yesterday, the Army had been claiming about 2,300 soldiers had deserted last year. But the actual number is actually near 3,200. The number of soldiers gone AWOL last year jumped by 27% over 2005. The new figures were released 2 days after National Public Radio revealed the Army had been inaccurately reporting desertion figures. Overall, the Army estimates about 22,500 soldiers have deserted since fiscal year 2000. And the actual number is even higher because the Army's date does not reflect deserters from the National Guard or the reserves. John Bolton, the former top U.S. diplomat, has revealed the Bush administration deliberately resisted calls for an immediate ceasefire during Israel's invasion of Lebanon last summer because it wanted to give Israel more time to carry out military strikes. Bolton, who at the time was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, said the U.S. decided to join efforts to end the conflict only when it was clear Israel's campaign wasn't working. Bolton told the BBC he was, quote, damn proud of what we did to prevent any early ceasefire, he said. Bolton also said the U.S. was deeply disappointed at Israel's failure to remove the threat from Hezbollah. More than 1,000 Lebanese civilians and 43 Israeli civilians died in the war. Israel also lost 116 soldiers. The total number of Hezbollah fighters killed is unknown. Israeli border guards have been caught on camera beating a 17-year-old Palestinian student in a West Bank village near Nablus. The incident was filmed by a local resident on Wednesday. The beating occurred after the Israeli guards questioned and detained three Palestinian youths who had just left school. This is Bassem Eid, the head of the Palestinian Human Rights Monitoring Group.
I think that beating Palestinians today becomes as a kind of a disease among the Israeli soldiers and the border police and even the Israeli regular police. Our organization almost received a lot of complaints from Palestinians not even only children, but even elder people, women, that has been beaten at the checkpoints by the Israelis.
And the Indian government has awarded Kenyan environmentalist and Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai its top international award for her contribution towards peace and for her fight against environmental degradation. In 2004, Wangari Maathai became the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She spoke yesterday in New Delhi.
In order to live in peace with each other, we need to govern justly and fairly, respect the rule of law, respect human rights, and give voice to the majority and the minorities as well. This is more likely to preempt many of the conflicts and the root causes that cause them.
Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. On Capitol Hill, a Senate committee approved a $122 billion war spending bill that calls for President Bush to pull combat troops out of Iraq by next spring. The House plans to vote on a similar bill later today. Bush has threatened to veto both bills if they contain a deadline for withdrawal. The legislation comes as the United States enters its fifth year of the occupation of Iraq.
Yesterday, U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made a surprise visit to Baghdad during the joint news conference with Iraq's prime minister. The U.N. chief said he might boost the United Nations presence in Iraq because of improved security. Moments later, the news conference was interrupted. A rocket exploded just 50 yards away from the meeting. The blast shook the building and sent Ban Ki-moon ducking for cover behind a podium. The UN chief had earlier arrived on his first visit to Baghdad since he took office in January this year. Today, we're joined by a former UN official who lived in Iraq before the U.S. invasion. Hans von Sponeck has been a fierce critic of the war in the late 1990s. He was the coordinator of the United Nations humanitarian mission in Iraq. He resigned in protest over the U.N. sanctions regime. He's also a former assistant secretary general of the U.N. and has written a new book. It is called A Different Kind of War, the U.N. sanctions regime in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. First, the situation. I mean, you just heard the explosion as the new UN Secretary General was announcing there seems to be increased stability and maybe a larger UN mission would come into Iraq.
It gave him a first-hand opportunity to understand how volatile the situation is in Iraq. And I hope it leads him to the conviction that less violence and more peace initiatives on the part of the United Nations might be the answer, rather than a surge in troop levels. I very strongly feel there should be a surge in the willingness in the U.S. Congress to insist that the United Nations, the role of the international community, should be strengthened and the troops should come home with respect and honor, if that is still possible, as soon as possible.
What is the role of the UN right now in Iraq? And given, obviously, it has to be very limited, anything that it can do, but what are UN personnel doing, if anything? There?
The United Nations staff, 55 of them, that's all, are confined to the Green Zone and to Amman. From a distance, they look at an Iraq that is crumbling. They can do very little. They do human rights reporting. They have a small number of projects, but essentially they are confined to that limited space for reasons of security. In fact, most of the staff that Ban Ki-moon has allowed to be in Iraq is security-related staff. So it's a holding operation. The UN flag can fly, but it flies very timidly.
Of course, the UN mission there was blown up. What was the effect of that?
It was a massive demoralization for the United Nations. Mr. Kofi Annan was right in taking the staff out, as painful as this is.
Sergio de Mello, the head of the mission, killed.
He was killed in my office. This is the office I occupied for the time I served in Baghdad. So I know the environment very well. It didn't come as a surprise. It was the weak, the soft, underbelly of the United Nations building area in Baghdad. And it's a tragedy it happened, but out of that should be a United Nations that is more and more determined to encourage dialogue rather than support an ill-fated attempt to solve problems in Iraq with military muscle.
Well, in your book, A Different Kind of War, you actually get into the entire period of the sanctions in Iraq, and you document quite a bit of information that I don't think, certainly most Americans are not aware of. But I was especially interested, we were talking before the show, about the United Nations Compensation Committee, commission that was set up to as after the Persian Gulf War. And you had quite a few examples there of what appear, at least on the surface, to be questionable awards that were given. Plus, there was a huge amount of money that was involved. Could you talk about the whole compensation commission?
Well, you know, I don't want to come across here as a vindictive person. The intention of this book was to shed light on a very dark chapter of the United Nations by honestly identifying facts. And among these dramatic facts is one which is hardly known, certainly very little known in the U.S., and that is at a time when an increasing number of people were dying, particularly children, the United Nations agreed to pay out $18 billion. That's a lot of money. The total value of what came into Iraq during the entire oil for food program in terms of supplies was $28 billion. So if you withhold $18 billion, that is a lot. That could have saved a lot of lives. That is bad enough. What is worse is that many of these compensation claims were fraudulent. The UN discovered some. Others were overlooked and paid out. There was a claim from the government of Jordan for having helped transiting guest workers to go home for $8.2 billion. The UN, in the end, awarded $79 million. Less than 1% of what was asked for. The Iraqi money was like a cow that one could milk eternally in order to please governments that didn't need the money while Iraqis back home were dying in large numbers. There are other examples, but maybe this would go too far on this occasion. Mm-hmm.
It's very relevant to look at the sanctions regime against Iraq given what is being proposed for Iran right now. Major powers have readied a draft resolution to slap new punitive sanctions on Iran with a UN Security Council vote expected on Saturday as Tehran remains defiant over its nuclear program. According to Agence France-Presse, a Western diplomat speaking on condition of anonymity said the draft was expected to receive overwhelming support. Talk about the regime of sanctions and what it meant. I mean, people see what's happening in Iraq right now as horrific. You describe a very bad situation before the bombing of George Bush of 2003.
You know, the sanctioned cheese in Iraq had many holes. The sanctioned cheese for Iran has bigger holes. It may look interesting on paper, but in terms of the reality for implementation, we are living today in a totally different situation. The world is more polarized than it ever was in the days of the sanctions against Iraq. But let me just pause here and say the comprehensive economic sanctions that Iraq endured isn't what is proposed for Iran. It's more a political threat to the Iranians rather than a direct punishment of the people as it was the case in Iraq. Moreover, we must remember, the world of 2007 is not the world of the Iraq sanction time. There are new constellations, new organizations are springing up in protest over what I would call, as a friend of the U.S., I would call it the Western one-way street, while in fact it is mainly an American highway on which we have traveled that the world is no longer to accept. So the sanction package against Iran, it may be a small, I don't think it is a political victory for the U.S. to get a sanctioned resolution through the Security Council. But in terms of the implications for Iran as a whole, it will have limited value.
You, in talking about Iraq today, are clearly saying that the U.N. is involved in supporting violent solutions. What exactly are you saying?
The United Nations, painful for me as a person who believes in the UN, who has served 32 years in that organization, was indeed an ally of bilateral policies that initially meant containing the country, and later, in the last years of the Clinton administration, and very much since then, was a policy of punishment, punishing a people for enduring a dictator, a very strange logic here. But we could have in Baghdad done whatever we wanted to do. The government could have cooperated with the Security Council. It would have made no difference because the key word in this equation was regime change. So as long as Saddam Hussein's government were in power, no chance to do something. As Mr. Negroponte in a hearing in the U.S. Congress some time ago said, our first concern were weapons of mass destruction. We were interested with the people's welfare, but that was clearly of second priority. That was the approach, and the UN went along with this. And why am I mentioning it? Because I think it is very relevant in the debate about the kind of United Nations that we want to have, that we need, that the U.S. needs as much as my country, Germany, or anyone else around the world in these 192 member countries. We need to take into account what happened in Iraq in debating the U.N. reform needs of today and tomorrow. And if we do this, then we do justice to the demand of political accountability. This is not looking to the future. Yes, we must look to the future. That demand from European politicians and American politicians is important, but not without looking back to understand what happened and to hold those on both sides of the fence. You have, I don't want to talk too long here, but I want to say you have in Iraq a very strange reality. You have two perpetrators. You have Saddam Hussein, who has committed crimes against his people, but you also have, tragically enough, you have a United Nations that has equally become a perpetrator in harming and punishing because of a faulty, I'm afraid to say, U.S.-led, British-led, Spanish, Italian-led policy in the Security Council.
I'm curious, in the period before you stepped down from your post, what kind of conversations you may have had with other leaders of the United Nations, of Kofi Annan directly, about the concerns about the UN's role and what their response was, because they obviously were aware of the negative role that the United States and Great Britain, some of the other great powers, were playing. And what kind of conversations did you have with them?
Mr. Kofi Annan at all times had the heart in the right place, but he didn't have enough muscle to succeed in convincing the Security Council that the rhetoric in the Council that was always pro-people, that always recognized the plight of the Iraqi people, should translate and be provided, equipped with the political will to bring about changes that would be more focused on the perpetrators, in this case the government of Iraq, rather than on innocent civilians. He knew that. Mr. Kofi Annan at no time forgot that, but a multilateral diplomat is impotent vis-a-vis the powers of the day if they have a different design. And the tragedy is that it is a 15-country Security Council that was overwhelmingly dominated by the United Kingdom and the United States, and the international community allowed this to happen.
You're here in the United States. You return to Germany tomorrow. You've been here at a genocide conference at Columbia University in New York. As you watch the coverage of what's happening today, there's going to be a vote in Congress for supplemental money, more than $100 billion, for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Your thoughts?
I want to tell you that we are very carefully watching in Europe what is being debated in Washington. And we cannot fully comprehend why this courageous woman, Nancy Pelosi, isn't making more progress among her colleagues on both sides of the fence. Why there are still Republicans who can argue that it is a betrayal of U.S. troops. I sympathize with these poor male and female GIs that have to serve in Iraq. But it is incomprehensible to me that there are still voices that insist that the way to go forward is to increase the troop levels, to maintain a policy that will lead in Afghanistan and in Iraq to total disaster. This is not winnable. You cannot do what is intended to be done. Democracy and human rights and progress in development cannot be parachuted over Kabul or Iraq. And why is it, I don't have an answer, why is it that so many members of the U.S. Congress still maintain that the old policies can remain intact and should be implemented?
If the U.S. troops pulled out today?
Can there be more chaos in Iraq than there is already? I have links to people who have links to the resistance. The resistance says the Americans should talk to us. But if Ambassador Khalilzad in Baghdad talks to resistance people, the real resistance leaders start laughing because they say, you are not talking to the right people. So Condoleezza Rice should have her way. Mr. Cheney should not have his way. She should succeed in convincing her cabinet colleagues that it's the moment is to talk to each other. The moment is to talk to the resistance. The moment is, you mentioned the PKK a moment ago, Hezbollah, Fatah, Hamas, they all belong around the table. You can no longer discuss an element of the Middle East crisis in isolation. It has to be, I call it, a strategy of the whole. Everybody belongs around the table and needs to be taken into account. If we don't recognize this, we will continue to waste money, our goodwill, your people's lives, and I think that is a tragedy. And I hope that Nancy Pelosi and her colleagues will make headway in convincing Republicans also to finally give up an unwinnable approach in dealing with the Middle East.
But you mentioned how in Europe people are watching very carefully what is happening here in the U.S. Congress. Obviously, European governments, several of them have gone through major changes since the start of the Iraq War. To what degree are the European nations doing what they should be doing in terms of standing up sufficiently? I mean, clearly, in Italy and Spain, the climate has changed dramatically. But what can Europe do in terms of having an impact on American policy?
The first order of priority in the European Union of 27 countries is to get our own act together, because we are very fragmented. There are many shades of opinion with regard to the Middle Eastern situation. And there is no integrated foreign policy. And that plays into the very hands in the U.S. that should keep their hands off the political debate. The neoconservatives are trying hard to maintain this level of division in Europe. And the sooner our leaders in Europe recognize that they will play no role, that they will have a marginal impact at best, until they get their act together. And my own country in Germany, Mrs. Merkel, our chancellor, is trying to repair the transatlantic damage. She tries very hard, but the fear some of us have is that she tries at the expense of doing what needs to be done now. And tell the friend across the Atlantic, tell Washington, in as a friend, that the track, the road on which the U.S. administration is traveling is leading to further disaster.
Hans von Smoneck, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, was the chief of the UN humanitarian mission in Iraq, quit over the sanctions regime. and has written a book now translated into English, A Different Kind of War, The UN Sanctions Regime in Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the U.S. government fining Chiquita $25 million for funding an organization in Colombia designated a terrorist organization by the United States. Stay with us.
And glory more for the Commodore when the deeds of might are told. They stand to the deck through the battle's wreck when the great shells roar and pound. And never they fear when the foe is near to lay their orders down. But off with your hats and three times three for every sailor's son. For the men below who fight the foe, the men behind the guns. Oh, the men behind the guns. Their hearts a-pounding heavy when they swing to port once more. With never enough of the greenback stuff, they start for the leave ashore. And you'd think perhaps the blue-blouse chaps had better clothes to wear. For the uniforms of officers could hardly be compared. Warriors bold with straps of gold that dazzle like the sun. Outshine the common sailor boys, the lads who serve the guns. Oh, the men behind the guns. But say not a word till the shot is heard that tells the fight is on. And the angry sound of another round says they must be gone. Over the deep and the deadly sweep of the fire and the bursting shell, where the very air is a mad despair, the throes of a living hell. But down and deep in a mighty ship unseen by the midday sun, oh, you find the boys who make the noise, the lads who serve the guns, oh, the men behind the guns. And well they know the cyclone blow loosed from the cannon steel, and they know the hull of the enemy ship will quiver with the feel, and the decks will rock with a lightning shock and shake with a great...
The men behind the guns, Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The Cincinnati-based fruit company Chiquita has found itself at the center of another major controversy over its practices in Latin America. On Monday, Chiquita admitted it had paid off the group United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, which is considered a terrorist organization by the United States government. Chiquita has agreed to pay the U.S. government a fine of $25 million on the condition that it doesn't have to reveal the names of executives that were involved. The $25 million penalty comes out to around half of what Chiquita received from selling its Colombian subsidiary in 2004. Chiquita has defended the payment, saying it fell victim to an extortion racket that threatened its employees. This is Chiquita Senior Vice President James Thompson.
The payments made by the company at all times were motivated by the company's good faith desire and concern for the safety of all of its employees. Nevertheless, we also recognized our obligation to disclose the facts and circumstances of this admittedly difficult situation to the United States government and the Department of Justice.
Chiquita Senior Vice President James Thompson. Colombian authorities have taken a different view. Colombia's Attorney General has said he will seek the extradition of 8 Chiquita employees allegedly involved in making the payments. The Attorney General, Mario Iguarán, said, quote, the relationship was not one of the extortionist and the extorted, but a criminal relationship. When you pay a group like this, you are conscious of what they are doing. Colombian prosecutors have also accused Chiquita of providing arms to the right-wing paramilitary groups that were then used to push leftist rebels out of an area in northern Colombia where Chiquita had its banana plantations.
This isn't the first time Chiquita has been accused of criminal activity in Colombia and Latin America. And for more on the story, we're now joined by 3 guests. Here in our Firehouse studio in New York, investigative journalist Nicholas Stein has covered Chiquita for Fortune magazine and the Columbia Journalism Review. Joining us in Washington, D.C., Adam Isaacson, director of the Columbia program at the Center for International Policy. On the phone from Columbia, Ignacio Gomez, renowned journalist who has broken major stories on Chiquita's dealings in Colombia. We're going to go first to Adam Isaacson in Washington, D.C. Talk about, first, what the developments this week, this $25 million fine on Chiquita that it has agreed to pay, and the history of the Chiquita Brands International, Chiquita Company.
Sure. First, what the guilty plea agreement says is that Chiquita, over the course of 7 years between 1997 and 2004, made 100 or more payments totaling about $1.7 million to the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, which most people just call the paramilitaries. The United Self-Defense Forces, which are on the United States list of terrorist groups, have killed about 20,000 Colombians in the last 20 years. And they are responsible for about three-quarters, actually, of all killings in Colombia in the last 20 years. And they were founded by large landowners and by factions of the military, as well as by and financed by drug lords. So these guys came to Chiquita Brands in 1997 and said to them, "We're going to kick the guerrillas out of the Urabá region," which is the region in northwestern Colombia where the banana, really the banana heartland of Colombia. "And we want money from you in order to do this." And Chiquita, you know, took this as a threat, but willingly made the payments over the course of a long time. And indeed, the paramilitaries in that Urabá region, day after day, carried out massacre after massacre, killing thousands of people and cleansing the region, not just of guerrillas, but of most civilian non-combatants, and especially anybody who was trying to organize the labor unions, the laborers in the banana plantations. Now, Chiquita, for those of you who have studied Latin America in the past, Chiquita used to be called United Fruit. And it's hard to actually have a course on the, you know, in high school or college on the history of the United States and Latin America without having, you know, at least passed over what the United Fruit Company, because it has a pretty bad reputation over the last really 80 or 90 years. United Fruit basically introduced the banana to the United States around the turn of the last century. But in doing so, they became very wealthy and accrued huge land holdings all through Central America and in the north of Colombia, and became so powerful that they were really the kingmakers. They had the ears of presidents, and they orchestrated military coups. They made sure that whoever was in power in the countries where they were was favorable to United Fruit's investments. One of the most notorious cases was in 1954 in Guatemala, when the elected president of Guatemala decided to try to expropriate some of the unused land that United Fruit had control of. The CIA, claiming they were communists, helped orchestrate a coup, and Guatemala had about 30 years of military dictatorships after that and a bloody, bloody civil war. Also in 1927, in Colombia itself, workers on United Fruit plantations in northern Colombia protested, and there was a massacre, which Colombians just called the Cienega Massacre, that killed hundreds. We don't even know how many were actually killed by that, but Colombians remember that to this day.
Of course.
Adam Isaacson, I wanted to ask you about the particular events of this past week, because my understanding is that the company informed the U.S. government a couple of years ago that it was making these payments, and suddenly now we're getting a plea agreement. Was there actually an indictment before a plea agreement, or did they just immediately go to court and plead guilty without even being charged?
There was an indictment, and I'm not exactly sure about the order in which it happened, but the document, the public document that you can read, is indeed an indictment. But yeah, Chiquita back in, it was in mid-2003, and then they publicly announced it in the spring of 2004 that they had voluntarily given this information to the U.S. Justice Department after they had made the decision to leave Colombia and also had some management changes. They'd voluntarily turned this over. So at the time, it looked like a really good example of, you know, what in the public relations people call scandal management. Get it all out now and don't stonewall and the thing will blow over. And it looked like it worked, because it was, you know, in 2004 when they made the announcement, there were a couple wire stories and then it just disappeared. This week there's a firestorm, and a key reason for that is the Colombian government's own reaction, saying that they're going to extradite some of these Cincinnati-based executives of Chiquita, which, you know, some people see as, you know, them trying to distract attention from an ongoing scandal involving the president's own supporters being tied to paramilitaries. Others see, though, as Colombians just being angry about, you know, they're extraditing hundreds of their own citizens to the United States to face trial for drug crimes. Meanwhile, U.S. citizens who have trafficked drugs out of Colombia, or who have, you know, paid armed groups, are getting slaps on the wrist. And so it really taps into some resentment in Colombia. But it's kept the story very much up front this week.
Adam Isaacson, I wanted to bring Ignacio Gomez into the conversation, mm-hmm. renowned Colombian journalist, director of investigations for the Colombian public affairs television show, Noticias Uno. You're speaking to us from Bogota. Ignacio Gomez, your assessment of the $25 million fine and Chiquita's involvement in Colombia and the AUC, this paramilitary in Colombia?
What I think is that U.S. media is losing the complete picture, because in Colombia we're not talking just about the recent case and the payments. We are talking about a complete story of corruption since Chiquita came back in 1994 in Colombia. And according to the court documents, to run the biggest operation in war here from Turbo, Antioquia, in the Urabá Gulf, in the north of the country. What happened then was that Chiquita did a payment, an illegal payment, to the Colombian custom for them to get a port facility. And this port facility was the headquarters of the banana block of a lot of operations of the Bloque Bananero of the AUC. I mean, the case also involves a
very... Ignacio, can you explain what the AUC does, for the paramilitary? Most Americans have never even heard of it.
Well, since the beginning, in 1988, when the banana operation started to go on in Urabá, the union tried to negotiate a complete bill for the entire workers of the zone. And the banana managers wanted to negotiate farm by farm. The guerrillas started to be involved in the organization of the union. And the paramilitary start to run a killing operation. There were more than 4 massacres in 88, and the final operation for them start to take place in 1996, when Chiquita got the port facility to run the complete banana operation there.
Adam Isaacson, let me ask about the AUC and about Chiquita saying they were paying this money, defending it, to say they were protecting their workers, when here we have Ignacio Gomez saying that the AUC was known for terrorizing them.
And Ignacio is right. The AUC, basically, just the origins of the AUC, about 20, 25 years ago, after wealthy Colombians and some of the newly rich drug lords in Colombia decided that they had had it with being harassed and extorted by guerrilla groups, they began to form citizen militias and arming them very, very strongly, and got a lot of help from the Colombian military in doing that. These sort of militias or vigilantes or self-defense groups soon became called paramilitaries, and they grew enormously, largely because of the drug money they were getting. And they operated not by fighting the guerrillas, on battlefields. They chose to fight citizens, civilians, who happened to live in areas under guerrilla control, like the banana heartland of Urabá, and began to target reformist or leftist leaders, too, leftist political parties, union organizers, school teachers, human rights defenders, and killed thousands of them. And this has continued up to the present day. The AUC is now formally demobilized after having negotiated with the government of the center-right government of Alvaro, really right-wing government of Alvaro Uribe in Colombia. But they still exist, and they still are carrying out killings right now. Now, in the banana-growing region that we're talking about, yeah, they were hitting up all of the anybody who owned a business, really, asking them for money, asking them for contributions. A lot of businesses gave these contributions willingly and admit that they did so because they were so tired of the guerrillas and were just happy to have a scorched earth campaign to make it possible to do business. Chiquita claims that they were under duress, but they made about 100 of these payments. So, eventually, after your 100th payment or so, the duress argument starts to wear a bit thin. Clearly, they probably were protecting their workers to some extent, because the paramilitaries would have been attacking their facilities had they not paid up, or they would have claimed that the guerrillas would have been. But in the end, they were really making it possible to do business in a very, very brutal way. The paramilitaries were, with the $1.7 million that came from Chiquita and more, some, probably more from other companies. Last point I'd like to make just quickly is that when this happened, 1996, 1997, the governor of the part of Colombia that we're talking about, who was governor while they were expanding the paramilitary presence in the Urabá region, was Álvaro Uribe, who is now president of the whole country.
Well, not, you mentioned that, and also you mentioned that the paramilitary groups have been largely disbanded. Carlos Castaño, their leader, was jailed. But yet, recently, as you also mentioned, there's been a lot of information in Colombia about ties the Uribe government officials to some of these same paramilitary groups. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, there's a growing scandal in Colombia right now in which information is leaking out, a lot of it coming from like paramilitary's own laptop computers and things that have been confiscated, and other witnesses coming forward showing that people like the head of presidential intelligence during Uribe's first term, governors, pro-Uribe governors of several departments or provinces in northern Colombia. Right now it's 10 senators and congresspeople, all from Uribe's bloc in Congress, either under arrest or fugitives, and several more already under investigation by the authorities. All of them being investigated for either meeting with and offering verbal shows of support to the paramilitaries, and in some cases even helping the paramilitaries plan and carry out massacres and operations. Already one military colonel has been caught up in this scandal, and even people in the defense ministry are expecting more military officers to fall under this. It's growing, it's snowballing. Every week there seem to be new arrests, and it's been what people who watch Colombia are not surprised by it, because we knew that there was a huge sector of Colombia's government and Colombia's ruling class that had made their deal with the paramilitaries, that had been in bed with them. And, you know, the fact that this is coming out now and that it's coming out in a big way is good for Colombia, but it's also important that people here in Washington are paying attention to it, because it does tell us a lot about who we have been aiding to the tune of $5.4 billion since 2000. And hopefully the new Democratic Congress will be going into its new aid for Colombia with its eyes wide open as information about this scandal continues to come north.
Interesting, this government should reveal this information, the fine, the $25 million, right after Bush leaves Colombia.
That is interesting. I guess that's mainly up to the Justice Department itself, that they didn't want this to cloud the headlines when President Bush spent his day in Colombia a week ago Sunday.
Adam Isaacson, I know you have to leave. We're going to go to break, but we want Ignacio Gomez to stay with us, and we'll also be joined in our New York studio by Nicholas Stein to talk about the expose of Chiquita that happened almost 10 years ago in the Cincinnati Inquirer, and how it is that wasn't followed up on, or why it was that the Cincinnati Inquirer ultimately apologized for doing the explosive expose it did. Adam Isaacson, director of the Columbia Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington. We'll be back in a minute.
Mi canto es un canto libre que se quiere regalar.
Mi canto es un canto libre.
A quien le estreche su mano, a quien quiera disparar.
Mi canto es una cadena,
sin comienzo ni final.
Canto Libre, Victor Jara here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are in Bogota, Ignacio Gomez, renowned Colombian journalist, broken two major stories on Chiquita. He is a public affairs television show director of investigations for Noticias Uno, also joined in studio by Nicholas Stein, who is a journalist here in New York, has covered Chiquita for Fortune magazine and also for the Columbia Journalism Review, where you covered the remarkable expose done by the Cincinnati Inquirer in 1998. First, explain what this expose was and then what happened. Cincinnati, the place where Chiquita is based.
Exactly. I mean, you have to realize that Chiquita, other than perhaps Procter & Gamble, was the biggest company in Cincinnati. And at the time that this story unfolded back in 1998, Carl Lindner, who was then the chief executive and majority owner of Chiquita, was one of the, certainly the most powerful person in Cincinnati and one of the most politically influential people in the whole country. So Inquirer readers opened their newspapers one day to find an 18-page special section in the newspaper with the headline "Chiquita Secrets Revealed," and it was essentially a months-long investigation done by two journalists at the Inquirer that went into all sorts of sordid details about behavior that Chiquita had allegedly been involved in various parts of their business in Latin America. And it was, it really, in Cincinnati, it became a huge story, and it was picked up on a lot by the national media as well.
But then subsequently, the Inquirer, in essence, disavowed its own story, pulled it from its website. The reporters ended up leaving the paper, didn't they? And could you talk, what happened afterwards?
Yes, well, this is where the story gets even more remarkable, because about 8 weeks after this 18-page section runs, people in Cincinnati pick up their papers again, and they see on the front page across all six columns of the page, apology to Chiquita. And essentially, as you say, the story was completely disavowed. It turned out that...
And we're talking, by the way, a story that alleged the use of illegal pesticides banned in the United States, used on communities in Colombia,
yes.
The suppression of workers in Latin America working in Chiquita plantations and factories, talking about bribing of officials, a whole series of allegations.
A whole series of human rights abuses were alleged. There were allegations that Chiquita had created these special shell companies in order to try and get around various laws and avoid paying taxes and submitting to various laws in several Latin American countries. And just to take a step back for a moment, it's very important to realize that this is just as what's unfolding in Colombia right now. This isn't an isolated incident with Chiquita or with the United Fruit Company. I mean, it's sort of hard to overstate how much influence this company has had over the last 100 years in Latin America. I mean, essentially, most of the roads were built by United Fruit. The railways were built. The towns and villages and hospitals and schools and on and on and on. I mean,
it controlled for a long time a lot of the shipping fleets that transported goods back and forth.
Exactly. Chiquita had what was called the Great White Fleet, which was the largest private shipping fleet in the world. And, before air travel, if people wanted to get back and forth between Latin America and United States or Europe, Chiquita was the way to go.
So what happened to this? Why was it not only retracted, but why did Cincinnati Inquirer pay the Chiquita company something like
$14 million. I mean, this what essentially happened was 8 weeks after the initial story, there's this front page apology in the paper, and the announcement that Chiquita has settled with the paper, which is owned by Gannett, also the publisher of USA Today and one of the largest media companies in the country. And on top of that, they've agreed to pay a $14 million fine. The lead reporter on the story, a guy by the name of Mike Gallagher, was fired. And that's really where you get to the heart of what happened in this story, because apparently Gallagher had hacked into Chiquita's personal voicemail system. At the time, this was before email was widely used, and the way that the executives at the company would communicate with one another was to leave voicemail messages for each other. And Gallagher, as it later came out in grand jury testimony, where he pled guilty to hacking into the system, he had told his editors, apparently, that somebody else had given the information to him. And this a big deal was made about this in the initial report. There were sort of illustrations, photos of cassette tapes, and apparently he had more than 2,000 of these messages, and a lot of his reporting was based on the content of these messages.
So the stories were never proved wrong, though the corporate media made a big deal of saying the Cincinnati Inquirer got it wrong. It was the way Mike Gallagher had done it, and we don't know where Mike Gallagher is today. But it had a tremendous effect on the future reporting on Chiquita. I'm sure reporters around the country afraid to touch it.
Well, I did a big story for Fortune magazine a few years later on Chiquita, and I got the opportunity to go down and visit some of their farms in Latin America and to spend some time with a lot of their senior executives. And I asked them specifically about the allegations that were made in the Cincinnati Inquirer report, and they denied that any of these things were actually going on, I think that
I want to end though with, yes, Ignacio Gomez, because he is still with us in Colombia, in Bogota. While Chiquita denied, can you in this last minute talk about the significance of what has taken place? Chiquita having to pay the government $25 million. Do you think things will change in Colombia, Ignacio?
No, I think you're losing the big picture. When the conversation my colleague is talking about, it was a conversation between Reynaldo Escobar, the president of Chiquita here, and Eric Olson, the manager of Chiquita there in Cincinnati. And they were talking about a bribe to get a port facility. This port facility was used in November 20, 2001, to import a gas shipment for the AUC. This big shipment was investigated by the Organization of American States, and this report talks about the involvement of Chiquita there.
Ignacio, we're going to have to leave it there as the show ends, but we're going to continue to follow this story. There is a lot that we have not gotten a chance to go into in the exposés around Chiquita. Ignacio Gomez speaking to us from Bogota, Nicholas Stein here in New York, investigative journalist. Our website is democracynow.org. We'll link to the old Cincinnati Inquirer story. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Matei, Jen Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Andrew Quinn, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Julian O'Connor, Tori Townsend, Samantha Chamblier, Amy Goodman, Warren Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.